KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
We can build an amazing battery industry here. We have the opportunity here to really, really accelerate.
The U.S. and China are competing to revolutionize the electric vehicle industry.
We'll check on the great battery race that's underway this Wednesday, May 21st, on All Things Considered.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Ahead this hour, could a new blood test change the way doctors diagnose and treat Alzheimer's?
I think the blood test is going to really revolutionize the way people with Alzheimer's are cared for and diagnosed. It's a really big breakthrough.
Also, 5 days after a jailbreak in New Orleans, some of the fugitives are still on the run.
Wouldn't surprise me that the remainder of these guys are holed up somewhere with either a relative or other associates, and they're being actively hidden.
We'll ask an expert on manhunts how they work and what the public can do to help.
That's all coming up after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. A federal judge in Boston says the Trump administration violated his order requiring migrants being deported to countries that are not their own be given enough time to challenge their removal. NPR's Toby Smith reports those responsible may face criminal penalties.
8 migrants were flown out of the U.S. 17 hours after they were told they were being deported to South Sudan. Government lawyers argue that was enough time for them to raise concerns about their safety, but none did. In a stern rebuke, federal judge Brian Murphy said officials unquestionably violated his order to ensure due process, and he wants DHS to hear any concerns from the men now, either back in the U.S. or where they are, which remains unclear. Tina Realmuto, a lawyer for the migrants, is skeptical.
We think that will be a legal and logistical nightmare. I mean, we have concerns.
Government attorneys, meantime, raise concerns for the safety of the ICE agents holding what officials have described as criminals and barbaric monsters. Tovia Smith, NPR News, Boston.
Penn State is weighing a plan to shut down 7 of its 19 campuses. The decision comes as the university faces serious enrollment declines, which NPR's Jonky Mehta reports is part of a broader pattern in higher education.
The Penn State Governing Board will soon decide the fate of the 7 campuses and the future of the state school. The board's proposal to do so cited challenges including, quote, declining enrollment, stagnant state funding, rising operational costs. The proposal also says Penn State is not alone. The problem facing universities comes from what's called the enrollment cliff. There are fewer high school graduates heading to college, both because of lower birth rates and because more students are opting for alternatives to college. In the coming years, many higher education institutions will face similar existential decisions. Penn State's governing board will vote on the potential closures Thursday evening. Jonky Mehta, NPR News.
The ongoing uncertainty over President Trump's tax and spending cut plan, along with the fact that it appears his so-called big, beautiful bill will only add to the nation's deficit, rattled Wall Street today. Stocks slumped as bond yields climbed. NPR's Maria Aspen says uncertainty over the budget, along with inflation worries, fears of a recession, and Trump's tariff war, is creating a climate for investors to look for other places to park their money.
Investors are worried that the United States is in trouble, and so they're selling things that are tied to its economy. I talked to Winnie Caesar, who's the global head of strategy at CreditSights, and this is how she put it.
The whole change in narrative around U.S. economic exceptionalism and just a general perception that the U.S. is perhaps a riskier place to park your cash than it was 6 months ago.
And this all does come back to these tariffs.
NPR's Maria Aspen. The Dow plunged more than 800 points today. The Nasdaq was down 270 points. This is NPR. It now appears most of the book titles pulled from the U.S. Naval Academy Library in Trump administration's DEI purge are back on the shelves. Officials say all but a few of the 400 books removed because they dealt with anti-racism or gender issues and have been returned after a Pentagon order. Defense officials say about 20 books from the Academy's library are now earmarked for review. Administration officials had initially called for any books at military academies dealing with diversity, equity, and inclusion to be removed. The mayor of St. Louis has placed the city's emergency management commissioner on leave after the outdoor warning sirens failed to sound before Friday's tornado. Rachel Lippman has more from St. Louis.
Mayor Kara Spencer says Commissioner Sarah Russell and their staff were at an off-site meeting as the storm was moving into the area. That meant they were not in a position to activate the sirens, and a request to the St. Louis Fire Department to do the job instead was not clear. Spencer says she is shocked and horrified at the system's failure.
But I also want to be clear that I am confident in what we have done over the last 48 hours to ensure that we can reliably activate the system should we need to.
Spencer says she is arranging for a full outside review. The storm killed 5 people in St. Louis and caused at least $1 billion in damage. For NPR News, I'm Rachel Lipman in St. Louis.
Crude oil futures prices moved lower amid continued global uncertainties, including talks with Iran about its disputed nuclear program. Oil fell 47 cents a barrel to settle at $61.57 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. The car you drive years in the future might run off a battery being invented in a lab right now. There's a great battery race underway, a tech battle to create better electric vehicles. It has high stakes for drivers, companies, and the planet. China has the lead, but it's game on in Detroit. NPR's John Ruich and Camila Domonoski have our story from both sides of the globe.
At the Shanghai Auto Show this spring, you could not escape technology if you tried. There were no tickets or badges for reporters. Instead, at the entrance, I had to look into a camera.
And it's a face scanner that let us in, so high tech right at the gate.
The tech on display is part of why thousands of people have come to the event. Dai Yao from Shanghai brought his 12-year-old son along. He says he wanted to open his eyes to all the development that's happening. And as I wander from display to display, car company after car company, there is a lot to take in. Cars that can pivot on the spot. Cars that can operate in water like a boat. Concept cars with quadcopter rotors on them. And this.
It's the world's first drone system that only designed for the vehicle.
You can launch the drone to follow your vehicle, or it can speed ahead, the salesman explains.
If I have a traffic jam, I can take off my drone and see what happened in the front.
A few steps away is perhaps a more consequential advancement. It's from BYD, the world's biggest EV maker by sales and China's top brand. This is a demo of what the company calls flash charging. It's charging at high voltage, which requires special batteries that are so efficient that they don't overheat. An engineer explains the benefits. It can add more than a mile of range per second of charging, and almost 250 miles in just 5 minutes. By contrast, U.S. market leader Tesla's fastest charger takes more than 3 times as long. BYD says it's pioneering fast charging to eliminate anxiety about charge times and vehicle range, a major concern for EV owners. The engineer, who declined to give his name, citing company policy, says it takes less time to charge this car than your mobile phone. BYD plans to install 4,000 fast charging stations in China. None will be in the United States, though. Chinese cars are largely absent from the U.S. market. That's thanks to a combination of heavy tariffs and U.S. restrictions of web-enabled Chinese car technologies. Elsewhere, though, Chinese brands are drumming up excitement. BYD and others brought bloggers and influencers to Shanghai from around the world for the car show.
This is happening in real time.
Gio Taveras is an influencer from the Dominican Republic who makes videos about cars. He said BYD flew him out, all expenses paid.
I mean, the technology is already developed. You took the same time when you go to the gas station to put gas on your car.
BYD and others in China benefited from strong government investment and subsidies, and some say that helped them get ahead. CATL, another leading Chinese battery firm, announced that it, too, is rolling out ultra-fast charging car batteries by the end of the year. It's also launching a battery powered by sodium, which is cheaper and more readily available than lithium. When BYD's fast charging demo is over, a group of men in suits crowds around a BYD employee. One peppers him with questions about how it all works. Before they walk away, I ask who they work for. The Japanese, one man says. Dai Yi Yao, with his 12-year-old son, says that's become the norm these days.
I told my son, it used to be that we were the ones with our pens out evaluating the cars.
Now, foreigners are learning from China. He says he thinks foreign companies have been resting on their laurels, which has put China in the driver's seat.
Now, Western companies would say they're not resting on their laurels at all. No American company has announced anything like five-minute charging, but companies are very focused on batteries that would make EVs cheaper and let them drive farther. Scientists have been working on that for years in GM's R&D labs north of Detroit.
Oh my God, it's such a maze. Do you get lost?
In here, yes. Especially
GM battery engineer Andy Oury is walking with journalists on a rare tour of the labs. Last week, GM announced a new battery design developed here, a breakthrough. Each room in here focuses on one tiny piece of the battery puzzle. Making new ingredients for batteries, analyzing them, combining them. Competitor batteries are also torn apart for study, and yes, that definitely includes Chinese tech. Batteries are made of alternating layers of chemicals. With big fans whirring, GM battery engineer Nicole Ellison explains part of the process of turning raw materials into that battery.
We mix these all together in essentially what we have here is your KitchenAid mixer. We want to make a nice cake batter of this solution.
Behind her, in a sealed room, two people are carefully pouring a black liquid, which does, in fact, have the consistency of cake batter. Baking metaphors also help explain GM's recent breakthrough. Here's Andy Oury again.
So it's all about how much of each ingredient, how do you process it, how do you mix it?
The same ingredients, eggs, butter, milk, but different processes can make everything from scrambled eggs to popovers.
Right, very different. Same ingredients.
Okay, so now imagine if you want to make a cake cheaper, but still taste good. You could cut down on the more expensive ingredients, but it won't taste right, unless you can somehow tweak the baking process to compensate. And that's what GM did. GM's new battery uses more manganese, which is cheap, and a lot less nickel and cobalt, which are pricey. But GM says it holds as much energy and lasts as long as batteries packed with more expensive stuff. Sam Abul Samad, Vice President of Market Research for Telemetry, says this is good in a few ways.
You've got that lower cost, but also you've got the ability to source the materials from more places.
Evelina Stoiku is with Bloomberg NEF, a research company.
It's also exciting that there's a roadmap and there's a timeline on when we expect to see it in vehicles.
By 2028, GM says. Now, this breakthrough is really a tweak to today's battery recipe. There is also a race to develop something totally new. Lots of labs, including smaller startups, are working on things like solid-state batteries, a new design that promises a huge boost in performance. If today's batteries are like a cake, solid-state would be a different dessert altogether. But those recipes are not ready yet. It's an open question who will perfect them first. Kurt Kelty runs GM's battery program. After years at Tesla and other companies, he acknowledges in the race for new battery tech, China has an advantage.
Some of these Chinese companies have massive R&D teams, and they're getting a lot of funding from their governments.
But he points out the types of batteries that Asian companies make so well were developed in the U.S.
They're all invented here.
Before being scaled up in Asia, where the manufacturing was. Today, American labs are still coming up with new battery ideas. So he argues,
we can build an amazing battery industry here. We have the opportunity here to really, really accelerate.
And even go beyond Chinese tech, he says. If demand for batteries in the U.S. can drive innovation from start to finish, from research lab all the way to massive factories.
Camila Domonoski, NPR News, Warren, Michigan.
And John Ruich, NPR News, Shanghai.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Capital One, offering their premium travel card, Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com.
A new blood test for Alzheimer's is promising to change the way doctors diagnose and treat the disease. NPR's John Hamilton reports on the first test of its kind to be cleared by the Food and Drug Administration.
The test is for people 55 and older who already have memory problems or other signs and symptoms of Alzheimer's. The results show whether a person also has sticky amyloid plaques in their brain, a finding that confirms the disease. Dr. Howard Fillett is chief science officer of the Alzheimer's Drug Discovery Foundation.
I think the blood test is going to really revolutionize the way people with Alzheimer's are cared for and diagnosed. It's a really big breakthrough.
Fillett says one big change will be more accurate diagnoses. Right now, he says, primary care doctors get it right only about 60% of the time.
Specialty neurologists get it right like 70-80% of the time. And with the blood test, we can get it up to over 90% of the time being accurate.
A PET scan is the gold standard for detecting amyloid plaques, but it's costly and unavailable in many communities. Another option is to test fluid from a spinal tap, an invasive procedure that most doctors and patients tend to avoid. Fillett says an FDA-approved blood test will mean that many more people will be diagnosed when symptoms are still mild and potentially treatable.
It's going to increase the number of patients in the community who have a definitive diagnosis of Alzheimer's, and those are the people who would be eligible for treatment.
That treatment will likely be one of two amyloid-reducing drugs now on the market. Doctors can already order amyloid blood tests that haven't been cleared by the FDA. So far, though, those tests have been used primarily for research and in large medical centers. Maria Carrillo, chief science officer for the Alzheimer's Association, says a test cleared by the FDA should change that.
It gives us more confidence in testing. It also means it's been through rigorous evaluation, and it provides guidance for prescribers on who is eligible and when the test should be provided in the course of an evaluation.
Carrillo says that will encourage more testing of people in rural or underserved areas.
Blood tests have given us an opportunity to really democratize this type of testing.
It also means a definitive diagnosis will be delivered to more of the estimated 7.2 million Americans now living with Alzheimer's. So Carrillo says the Alzheimer's Association is writing guidelines for doctors on how to speak with their patients about the results of a blood test and what it means to live with the disease. John Hamilton, NPR News.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Capital One, offering their premium travel card, Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. From Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. As they ripped out a toilet and sink and cut a hole in the wall, the 10 inmates escaping a New Orleans jail left a message, "Too easy, LOL." Laugh out loud. They also put a spelling error in there. Well, they left that message when they escaped last Friday. As of today, 5 of the 10 have been apprehended, but the manhunt for the others is still on. Well, we wanted to talk through what an operation of this scale might look like with Donald Lane. He's a former Secret Service agent who spent time on a fugitive apprehension task force. Donald Lane, welcome.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you with us. Is there a checklist for something like this? Just walk me through the first few steps when a jailbreak like this happens.
Sure. You know, when a jailbreak happens, the first thing you want to do, obviously, is identify who the individuals are that have escaped. And if there's any video that's available to show where they escaped from, which in this case they do. You can see them, some of them running across, you know, an interstate highway, for instance. So that gives you an idea of perhaps in the direction that they may be traveling. So
what they were wearing, where they were headed. Yep.
Right. You want to make sure that you begin to alert all law enforcement in the area. So, you know, identification, notification, and then you want to set up a perimeter as quickly as you can. Now, in this case, there was such a tremendous delay from the time that the escape actually occurred until the time it became known, you know, it's going to be difficult to put up a perimeter considering how far they may have gotten.
It was like 8 hours that it took jail staff to discover the escape.
Correct.
Which is a lot of running time if you're trying to catch people who are not interested in being caught.
It's a lifetime for a fugitive, yes.
You mentioned letting all the relevant law enforcement in the area know. In a operation like this, I've got to think you would have local police involved, state police, U.S. Marshals, FBI. Who takes charge?
Typically, the agency that leads this would be the one where the escape occurred, in this case, the Orleans Parish Sheriff's Office. But the reality of the situation is that most of the folks in law enforcement are going to take their cues from the U.S. Marshals Fugitive Apprehension Team. You know, that's what they do day in and day out. They're experts at hunting down fugitives. And so, you know, you would rely heavily on them at the federal level.
Some of the escapees, some of the fugitives I mentioned, have been apprehended. Louisiana State Police Superintendent Colonel Robert Hodges said that was with the public's help. Public tips, how helpful are they typically when you're looking for a needle, or in this case, 10 needles in a haystack?
The public tips become vital. They're not just important, they're vital. You know, fugitives are going to stay away from any law enforcement as best they possibly can. So, you know, you want the public to have their eyes open, their ears open. If they see anything out of the ordinary, and I think that's why you've seen some success, which has involved public notification.
Given all the tools at law enforcement's disposal, does it surprise you at all that here we are coming up on, not quite a week out, but coming up on it, and this is where we are?
It doesn't. This is a large amount of folks, you know, that escaped at one time. You know, they've captured some so far, but my belief is that these folks probably did not go far. I believe that they're going to stick to the areas they know best within the city of New Orleans. And it wouldn't surprise me that the remainder of these guys are holed up somewhere with either a relative or other known criminal associates, and they're being actively hidden and fed and housed. And, you know, then it becomes a waiting game. I do believe in time they'll all be apprehended, but these things sometimes take time.
Former Secret Service agent Donald Lane talking us through the manhunt underway in New Orleans. Donald Lane, thank you.
You bet. Thank you.
Sometimes a hike in the woods can do wonders for your soul. That's a lesson that 7th grader Finn Connolly has to learn the hard way. He's at the center of a new middle grade novel titled The Trouble with Heroes by Kate Messner. Andrew Limbong, host of NPR's Book of the Day podcast, caught up with the author, where else, on a hike in the woods.
We met up in a little wooded area by a lake in Baltimore. It's nothing like the Adirondack Mountains Kate Messner is used to, but in the middle of book tour?
Yeah, I mean, I need fresh air and I need trees and sky and all that stuff.
While we talked, Messner repeatedly said that she needed this. She needed to be out here surrounded by old rocks and dirt. It's what separates her from Finn, the main character of her new book, The Trouble with Heroes.
Finn doesn't know it's what he needs. You know, he's a kid who has lost his dad 2 years before the book starts.
His dad was a New York City firefighter who made a pretty heroic save during 9/11, and he died during those early days of COVID. Now, Finn and his mom live way upstate New York in Lake Placid in the Adirondacks.
He's angry. He's failing 7th grade. He won't do what he calls the stupid poetry project, which is to complete 20 poems on the topic of heroes. And he just kind of explodes and vandalizes the cemetery, kicks over a gravestone that belonged to one of the first women to hike all 46 of the Adirondack High Peaks.
In real life, people in the Adirondacks take their hiking very seriously. To climb all 46 mountains is to become a 46er.
You climb them all, it's 350 some miles and 65,000 feet of elevation gain, and then they give you a little patch.
All of that. You could have just bought the patch.
Yeah. No, you can't buy the patch. Oh, that's the thing. You're not allowed to buy the patch unless you're a 46er.
So no stolen valor.
No cheating. No stolen valor.
Like I said, they take their hiking very seriously. Anyway, in the book, as punishment for the vandalism, Finn has to become a 46er. And while he's at it, he has to finish that poetry project on the topic of heroes, which is what the book is, a collection of Finn's poetry, struggling with these big emotions he has about living up to his father's ghost and why he can't seem to just be a regular kid like his friends. We took a break from walking, sat on a big rock, and Messner read one of the poems.
When somebody you love does something terrible, you're supposed to be shocked. You're supposed to say, "This is so unlike him," but no one's looking at me that way. They're just sitting calmly like I'm the wind blowing everything around, because that's what wind is supposed to do. It makes me stop mid-gust.
On top of the usual aches and pains of growing up, this is a middle grade book dealing with 9/11, COVID, death, grief, alcoholism. It's also funny. Finn is equal parts charming and annoying in the funny way kids his age tend to be.
We need that. We need to laugh when things are hard. My dad's critically ill right now, and I'm going to be going home soon to be with him. And my mom and my sister just sent me a picture of my sister in this big plastic hospital gown and told me it was the new fashion from Paris. And you need both. That's what it is to be a person, is to be able to hold all of that inside us at once.
Since we talked, Messner's dad died. The point still stands, though. If you're laughing or crying, remembering someone or enjoying someone's company, there are worse places to be than on a walk in the woods. Andrew Limbong, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Madera Arredondo was in his third year as Minneapolis' chief of police, the city's first black chief, when one of his officers killed George Floyd and his city exploded in rage.
No one was saying, yeah, Rondo, here's the playbook. When you're leading in crisis and you have to literally make life or death decisions, I will always lean towards life.
His reflections 5 years later, tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
That's All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Coming up, a tale of espionage involving the Kremlin and Brazil.
They were either so good at building their cover identities, or they genuinely loved their life in sunny Rio.
How the Russians turned Brazil into an assembly line for deep cover operatives after these news headlines.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. The Justice Department is backing away from civil rights cases against police departments in Minneapolis and Louisville, Kentucky. The decision comes just days ahead of the fifth anniversary of the murder of George Floyd. NPR's Ryan Lucas reports.
The head of the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division, Harmeet Dhillon, announced the moves and said the timing has nothing to do with the anniversary of Floyd's death, but rather with looming court deadlines. The department is moving to dismiss lawsuits against Louisville and Minneapolis that accuse them of unconstitutional police practices and would impose consent decrees to help ensure accountability. Dhillon says such consent decrees are too expensive, last too long, and have been badly used. The department is also closing investigations into police departments in six other jurisdictions, including Phoenix, Arizona, Trenton, New Jersey, Memphis, Tennessee, and Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
New data show a record-breaking amount of forested area disappeared in 2024. NPR's Rebecca Hersher reports fires were the main reason for the losses.
Researchers at the University of Maryland track how much forested area is lost each year in tropical areas around the world. In the past, agriculture has been the main reason that tropical forests are destroyed. But in 2024, fires were the leading cause of forest loss. Fires accounted for almost half of all forest destruction last year. That includes both wildfires and fires used to intentionally clear forested areas. And the total amount of forest loss last year nearly doubled compared to the year before. Forests are important for many reasons. They provide habitats for animals, clean the air, protect drinking water sources, and trap carbon dioxide that would otherwise contribute to global warming. Rebecca Hersher, NPR News.
This is NPR News in Washington. A large number of Americans are consulting non-traditional spiritual practices. That's according to a new survey. Catherine Post, a religion news service, reports.
According to a new survey from Pew Research Center, 3 in 10 American adults consult a fortune teller, tarot cards, or astrology at least once a year. Those practices are especially popular among younger adults and women. And, the survey finds, nearly half of LGBTQ Americans consult astrology at least once a year. Chip Rotolo of Pew says this isn't surprising.
These practices sometimes emphasize things like fluidity and openness.
Still, just 6% of U.S. adults say they rely on these practices when making major life choices, according to Pew. For many, it's just for fun. For NPR News, I'm Catherine Post.
An investigation in Tennessee has concluded that the fire that destroyed a historic black church in April was deliberately set. The church served as the headquarters for a 1968 sanitation worker strike, which brought the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. to Memphis. Officials say the fire at the Claiborne Temple was set in the downtown church's interior. It was undergoing a years-long renovation at the time. Stocks closed sharply lower on Wall Street today. The Dow was down 816 points. The Nasdaq Composite fell 270. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa was in the Oval Office today trying, he said, to reset the relationship between the two countries. But President Trump had other plans. As the two leaders began to answer questions from reporters, Trump did something unusual.
Turn the lights down, and just put this on. It's right behind you. Johan.
There's nothing this parliament can do with or without you. People are going to occupy.
He showed a 5-minute video montage to his guests. NPR senior national political correspondent Mara Liasson joins me now from the White House to explain. Hi, Mara.
Hi there.
So explain, what was this video?
Well, this was a planned moment, and the video showed leaders of a minority party in South Africa singing an apartheid-era struggle song called Kill the Boer, that's B-O-E-R, which means farmer or Afrikaner. And that is something that Ramaphosa says is rhetoric he rejects and always has. Whites, who account for about 7% of the population in South Africa, still own about 70% of commercial farmland. And whites, while South Africa does suffer from high crime rates, black people bear the brunt of violent crime in the country. But Trump has claimed for years, without evidence, that South Africa has allowed what he calls a genocide of white South African farmers. And so he showed him this montage that he said proved his point.
But you do allow them to take land.
No.
You do allow them to take land.
Nobody can take land.
And then when they take the land, they kill the white farmer. And when they kill the white farmer, nothing happens to them.
No. There is quite...
Nothing happens.
So you can hear Ramaphosa there saying, no, pushing back. Tell me more about his reaction.
Well, he came prepared for what clearly had the potential to be an explosive meeting. It's as if the South African delegation went to school on the Zelensky meeting. Yeah. Of course, that meeting that they argued on camera, the meeting ended abruptly. But Ramaphosa was prepared for an ambush. He was very calm throughout. He didn't try to argue with the president. And he brought with him some friends, some powerful white friends, to help him try to convince Trump.
I would say if there was Afrikaner farmer genocide, I can bet you these three gentlemen would not be here, including my Minister of Agriculture. He would not be with me. So it'll take him, President Trump, listening to their stories, to their perspective.
Okay, hang on, Mara. Who are these three gentlemen he's referring to?
There was his white Minister of Agriculture, who's from an opposition party, who vouched for Ramaphosa. He also brought two champion golfers from South Africa, including Trump's friend Ernie Els, and a billionaire luxury good magnate, Johann Rupert, who's also a Trump friend. And their message was very simple. They said, you know what? We do have a crime problem in South Africa. We need to work with you, our great partner on this. We need tech. We need Elon Musk's Starlink. We need all sorts of other kinds of crime-fighting machinery like drones that can help us.
Sounds like quite a day at the White House. Did they get to what Trump wants Ramaphosa to actually do?
Well, he was asked that question directly, and he said, I don't know. And later he was asked if he was convinced that genocide was occurring in South Africa. And despite his insistence that it was, he said, quote, I haven't made up my mind.
And then how did all this end? I'm remembering you referred to Zelensky's Oval Office meeting when that all went off the rails. He left the West Wing. He didn't even get lunch. Did Ramaphosa?
I think he got lunch. He kept his eye on his goal, which is to get investment from the United States and South Africa, which, of course, would give business to U.S. companies. And we're going to see which Trump emerges from these meetings, the expert practitioner of white identity politics, which he's been his whole career, or the deal maker looking for trade and investment deals, or maybe both.
NPR's Mara Liasson at the White House. Thanks, Mara.
You're welcome.
The Justice Department is backing off of civil rights investigations into several police departments across the country. It's moving to quash two proposed consent decrees. One is in Louisville, Kentucky, where police killed Breonna Taylor. The other is in Minneapolis, where George Floyd died at the hands of police 5 years ago. Louisville Public Media's Roberto Roldan has been following this and is with us now. Hi there.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What prompted the DOJ to investigate the Louisville Metro Police Department in the first place?
So there had been criticism of LMPD for decades, but the police killings of Breonna Taylor in March of 2020 was really the match that ignited this powder keg. It led to an entire summer of protests, investigations of the officers that were involved in the raid on Taylor's apartment. And then ultimately in 2021, the DOJ launched this probe. The investigation took 2 years, and it ended with a scathing report that accused law enforcement of constitutional violations and discriminatory policing in the Black community. This consent decree agreement that the city and the DOJ signed last year included dozens of proposed reforms that were meant to address the things that the report found.
So after that years-long process, did the consent decree go into effect? Did the reforms happen?
No, it didn't. So consent decrees have to be approved by a federal judge, and that just hadn't happened yet. Basically, consent decrees are settlements to lawsuits, so those allegations of misconduct were the basis for a civil rights lawsuit that the DOJ filed against the city. But in Louisville, a federal judge in December asked the city and the DOJ for more details about these allegations, which allowed time for the Trump administration to then come in January, continue to delay, and then this morning to file a motion to dismiss the whole thing.
What's the response been from city leaders and the community there in Louisville?
Mayor Craig Greenberg and the police chief have been promising for months now that they're going to implement the reforms regardless of what the Trump administration decided to do. And so today, just hours after the DOJ announcement, they held their own press conference and reiterated that. Bishop Dennis Lyons was at the press conference. He's a longtime civil rights and police reform advocate in Louisville. And what he said is that city leaders are saying the right things, but he questioned whether the Black community is actually feeling that change.
And that's, I think, where the mayor and the chief of police need to focus on is, you know, what is the Black community saying? I know what they're saying, it's statistics. But are we seeing what they see, and are we feeling?
What Lyons is referencing there is city officials presented stats about how crime is down, and they say community trust is improving. But he says he hasn't heard the same optimism from residents.
So where does Louisville go from here?
Well, it wasn't exactly a surprise to city leaders. Right after today's news from the DOJ, the mayor had his own reform plan ready to go. He released it. It's 200 pages long, and he's calling it a community commitment. It's basically a local consent decree. We're still working through it, but it does seem to include most of the reforms that the city and the DOJ already agreed to under President Joe Biden. One of the big challenges moving forward, I think, will be how the city provides the independent oversight that a traditional consent decree offers. The city says it plans to hire a third-party monitor to make sure that the police department follows through with those reforms. In Minneapolis, the police department is already under a similar consent decree with the state that officials say is going to remain in place. But Trump's DOJ is planning to drop 6 ongoing investigations into police agencies across the U.S., including Memphis and Phoenix, essentially ending the prospect of consent decrees in those places. The DOJ, meanwhile, says that these agreements are costly to local police departments and that they're a form of micromanagement.
That is Louisville Public Media's Roberto Roldan. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. The Triple Crown races are known for big hats and powerful horses. They are also heavily dependent on immigrant labor, and some of those workers lack legal status. As President Trump increases his focus on worksite enforcement, the horse racing industry is one of many that fear the consequences, as NPR's Jimena Bustillo reports.
It's before sunrise, and tucked in the back of the Churchill Downs racetrack in Kentucky, hundreds of workers can be seen weaving in and out of the white barns. Their silhouettes glow under the stadium lights as they mount their horses for a warm-up.
It's fun, like Derby Week, to come out and see everyone because they kind of have their moment of, like, celebrity.
That's Sherry Stanley. She's the executive director of the Backside Learning Center, a nonprofit organization that provides educational services to backstretch workers.
This is like definitely the most dangerous job in horse racing because they are the ones that are like teaching the horses how to become racehorses.
Horse racing generated some $36 billion in 2023, and it supports nearly 500,000 jobs. It's considered one of the oldest sports in America. And like other industries, including agriculture, entertainment, and manufacturing, it's reliant on immigrant labor.
There's a reason why we bring all these people in to actually make the machine of the United States go work.
That's Tom Rooney, president of the National Thoroughbred Racing Association.
If you take away that labor force, then you're really going to be putting cogs in that machine that it's not going to be able to work.
President Trump had a focus on worksite enforcement during his first administration. Many industries, like horse racing, were largely left untouched. Industry leaders believe Trump recognized the sizable impact of immigrant labor, and he catered towards his agriculture voting base, which tends to be largely Republican. But many aren't sure that they'll be spared this time. This second Trump administration is sending a united message. People without authorization have to leave. Here's Secretary of Homeland Security Kristi Noem.
He has backed that up with his policies that you don't get to come into this country and have the law apply to some people and not others, that the scales of justice should apply equally to everyone.
That message doesn't sit well with racehorse trainers like Dale Romans.
We can't operate without them, and we can't send them home and ask them to come back. There's nobody to do the work when they're gone.
Racetracks from California to Kentucky have held security briefings and sent out memos informing people of their rights if officials come to the tracks. The fear is not unfounded. Trump officials kicked off this term promising an increase in worksite enforcement. So far this year, Immigration and Customs Enforcement says it's sent 1,600 notices to businesses. They kick off the inspection process. Back in Kentucky, Stanley from the Backside Learning Center said the reliance on primarily Latino immigrants began in the 1990s.
The reasoning behind us opening was because, like, the demographic of the Backside was changing to mostly Spanish-speaking, and I think there were safety concerns because of language.
Trainers say they can't find anyone domestically to do the work. Rooney from the National Thoroughbred Racing Association says workers may show papers, and employers have limited ways to verify if they're real.
They might not have time to go through and, like, do whatever kind of checking, you know, because they need this guy to start work, by the way, right now.
Since February, ICE's worksite operations have resulted in 1,400 arrests. They've varied by industry, including construction, manufacturing, and food service. Employers in horse racing hope that there's a path toward securing their workforce. They say without the labor, even an old American pastime could disappear. Ximena Bustillo, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. I love a good spy story. And this one, it is really good. It involves the Kremlin and Brazil, an operation that involved Russia sending novices to Brazil, where they spent years building their cover identities, becoming Brazilian before deploying elsewhere in the world to spy. Jane Bradley is one of the New York Times reporters who broke this story. She's on the line from London. Hi, Jane.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Glad to have you with us. How many Russian operatives are we talking, and why Brazil?
Very good question. So we're talking about 9 Russian spies who were operating under Brazilian cover identities. And the question of why Brazil is kind of one of the first questions we had as well. And there's a couple of answers to that. The first is, Brazil itself is a very multicultural, diverse population. It's easy for anyone to blend in. And the second thing is that Brazilian passports are, you know, one of the most useful and powerful passports in the world. It gets you into a lot of countries without a visa. So it's a very powerful, useful passport to have. And then the other point is more interesting and more complex, which is the Brazilian ID system, how you obtain birth certificates, basically has an exemption, a loophole, if you like, that makes it easier to apply for a birth certificate than most other countries elsewhere. So that made it a really attractive target.
It's so much time. It's such an investment. Do we know, were you able to document whether it ever bore fruit? Was Russia able to use any of these operatives to gather useful intelligence?
It's such a tantalizing question, isn't it? And it's one we've tried to answer. And I think in a lot of the cases, we don't know. And that's partly because some of these Russian spies were clearly interrupted at the beginning or halfway through their training. They hadn't yet built those cover identities when Russia started recalling them for, you know, some reason or other. But we do have a clue in one spy. And this was a guy called Sergei Chukuzov. So he was probably the most successful of the spies. What happened is he had spent about 7-8 years in Brazil building up his law, building up his cover identity. And most interestingly, he had just got an internship at the International Criminal Court just as it was about to start investigating Russia for war crimes in Ukraine. But actually, when he turned up in the Netherlands, he was swiftly turned back from the border and sent back to Sao Paulo. And now the Brazilians, they got this call out of the blue, this tip-off from the CIA, telling them that there was a Russian spy, a suspected Russian spy, on a plane back to Sao Paulo, and they needed to get ready.
So let me jump in, because you bring us to the next thread of this tantalizing yarn, which is the CIA has a tip. They share it with Brazilian officials. I know there were many twists and turns, but what did Brazil do with it? How did they unravel this?
They went through his birth certificate and tracked down relatives connected to the mother listed on his birth certificate. And what they found is that his mother had died and never had any children. Huh. That's from a relative they spoke to. And his father, they found no record he existed. So that then gave them a way to prove that he wasn't who he said he was. And that led to Chukuzov becoming the linchpin of the whole Brazilian investigation. And they used that same tactic to then identify the others. And what specifically they were looking for was basically these ghosts in the system, people who posed as Brazilians who had authentic birth certificates, said they were born in Brazil, but they were basically, there was no record of them existing in Brazil until they suddenly appeared, you know, decades later as adults and started rapidly collecting these ID documents
right,
that most Brazilians spent their whole lives collecting.
Jane Bradley, where are these spies now?
It's a million-dollar question. We've been trying to find out, and we know that, obviously, Chukuzov, the first spy, he is still in a prison in Brasilia, thanks to the Brazilian cops' efforts. But with the other spies, they'd actually all, like, just slipped through the Brazilian cops' fingers as they identified them. And the intelligence officials we've spoken to from various countries believe that they're all now back in Russia.
When you took this story to Russian authorities for comment, as I'm sure you did. They admitted everything and were incredibly helpful in confirming it all on the record for you, right?
Of course they did. They did not.
Did you get any comment at all?
No, we've had a wall of silence from them, but that's not unusual, to be honest. But we're speaking to other intelligence sources and trying to get an answer to that very question, right? Where are they now? What's happened to them? And we know their friends, their lovers back in Brazil, certainly in the case of one of the spies known as Artem Shmulev, they have big questions about where their friend went. And actually, we thought they might feel a bit betrayed. But mostly they were either so good at building their cover identities, or they genuinely loved their life in sunny Rio, because they kind of didn't care too much that they'd been lied to. They just wanted to know that their friend Daniel, as they knew him, Artem's cover identity, was okay. Very forgiving of them. I don't know if I'd be that forgiving.
Jane Bradley, investigative reporter at the New York Times, talking about the story she and Michael Schwartz published today, headlined The Spy Factory. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, come on.
A decades-old music mystery has been solved.
Well, sort of.
Yeah, fans of the 60s rock band The Doors may be familiar with the mystery of frontman Jim Morrison's missing bust.
If you're not familiar, to catch you up, Morrison died in 1971 at the age of 27. In 1988, a marble sculpture of Morrison's head was stolen from his gravesite in Père Lachaise Cemetery in Paris.
And now it has finally reemerged, but the mystery endures.
French police announced Monday that they found the bust in an unrelated fraud investigation. Still covered in graffiti and missing small pieces that fans had apparently chipped away for souvenirs while it was still at the cemetery.
No word yet on where it has been all these years, but fans have had their theories.
We still don't know if the statue will be returned to the gravesite. Jade Gesini, a Paris tour guide, told the Associated Press he thinks it would be chaotic to have the famed singer's bust brought back to its original place.
I think it would be incredible if they put the bust back onto where it was, and it would attract so many more people. But the cemetery wouldn't even be able to hold that many people. I'm saying this as seriously as I can. The amount of people who would rush in here just to see the bust, to take pictures of it, it would be incredible.
For now, at least, some fans can rejoice knowing this decades-long strange mystery is at least partly solved.
Strange days, indeed.
Thanks for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. With a docking location in central Paris, Viking is dedicated to bringing curious travelers closer to destinations across France. Learn more at viking.com. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. From Fisher Investments, Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. Fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss.